Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 537. And I'm joined this week by Phil Barantini. And by God, are you going to hear a man enjoying a conversation here? I get to have a proper nerd out with Phil. Phil is a friend. I love Phil dearly, but I'm also a big fan of his work. He did a film called Boiling Point. He did a series called Boiling Point. I love them both. He did a film called Accused with my boy, Jay Johnson. We talk about all of that, but we talk about filmmaking and careers. Phil was in Band of Brothers and he had an amazing acting career, but it maybe didn't go how he wanted and certain things got in his way, certain struggles of his own got in his way. He got in his own way, maybe. He's had a hell of a journey. And yeah, it's a really good conversation. I think you're going to really enjoy this. Not going to ramble on too much more, obviously, because Boiling Point was a one-shot and a lot of you will know I'm obsessed with one-shots. I've shot numerous one-shot music videos. So if you've not seen them, check out the music video for Introduction. Check out the music video for Stunner. Check out the music video for No Whimpers. Check out the music video for Hungry by a band called War and Peace. I directed that. So yeah, I'm obsessed with pulling off a good one-shot. So this was obviously a dream conversation for me as well. But yeah, we're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can get all my merch. twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio. If you listen to this on the Wednesday, tomorrow night, October 26th, I'm doing a watch-along of the horror movie Host. It's my Halloween special. There'll be loads of good stuff going on. Starts at 7:30. It's completely free to watch. I'll be there. It'd be lovely to see you lot there. And you can support at patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. Yeah, let's get on with the podcast. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 537 with Philip Barantini. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And we're off to the races, mate. I'm joined today by Philip Barantini. How are you, sir?
I am very well, mate. Very well today. Yeah.
I love it. I'm delighted that we're getting to have a catch up, even if it's on a podcast.
I know.
How's it all been going? How's all the promo been going? It must be mad, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll get into it all, but yeah, it seems to be a lot. And you've had a lot in the last year or two, like all at the same time. So Malpractice is getting nominated for all these awards.
Yeah.
Boiling Point's about to come out. Accused has just come out. So it's one of those weird things, right? Of years of work and everything seems to be kind of happening at once.
Yeah, you never plan it that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I had my own way, it wouldn't have come out like that. You know what I mean? It kind of makes it look like I'm being quite narcissistic and a bit egotistical and go, let's just throw everything out together, you know?
But here's all my stuff.
Here's all my stuff, yeah. But no, it's mad how it just all sort of comes together like that. It's all about timing, isn't it, I suppose? And, you know, it's out of your hands once you the Netflix thing, you can't decide when it's going to come out for Accused, or the BBC, you can't say, oh, I want it to come out, you know, later than that, or whatever. It's out of your hands. So, but it's all coincidental, really. But yeah, mad, absolutely mad, mad. You know, Malpractice came out earlier this year and was really well received, like mad, you know what I mean? And then,
I mean, we'll get into that more because I think Neve Algar is just.
Oh. She's
one of the greats. Yeah. A two-time guest on here. I'm just, as soon
is
as
she?
I saw her in Calm with Horses,
oh yeah,
I was just like, well, or maybe it was in Virtues first, whichever one of them was first. I was like, who is this? And why haven't I been watching them for a decade? Because it seemed like she came out of nowhere and was just at such a level. And then everything since her Malpractice, the Ridley Scott one that I loved, she's just a beast.
Yeah, she's amazing. And she really throws herself into every part, you know what I mean? She really goes to town on it. I mean, she probably won't mind me saying this, but there's a point when we were doing Malpractice and there's a scene, I think it's in the last episode, and she has to she's basically now in the hospital bed and she's, you know, she's sort of overdosed, being like in episode five, the end of episode five anyway. He says, so I was like, oh, you just need to lie in the bed and just let the people around you do it. You know, you're basically out cold and they'll put like, you know, do the thing. Someone's going to put a candle in. And she's like, oh, mate, we've got like all the proper nurse consultants and the doctor consultants and all the proper equipment here. Why don't they just actually put the actual cannula into my arm? I was like, Niamh, no, we can't do that. We can't put an actual cannula in your arm.
Oh, and we don't need to do that.
And we certainly don't need to do that. Yeah.
So let's fucking do it.
She really does go like, you know, full in, and I respect that massively. Yeah, she's brilliant.
I've talked to her. I've had a note for ages to do a special episode called The Show Must Go On, and it's because of talking to Niamh and to Rosie Marcel privately about how this is a mad industry. And again, I want to talk about our mutual friend, Mr. Stephen Graham, but he's a great example as well. Is we watch these performances on screen and we go, wicked, that's amazing. Yeah. How do they do that? And it's like, they do that by putting themselves in really heavy places, and it can be a really mentally straining work. I know me and Niamh, and I said, me and Rosie have spoken when there's been periods where they love their job, adore the projects, but it's been fucking hard for their mental health. So I guess, I mean, leaning on that now, how do you balance that as a director? Because, you know, you come from acting, so you've got experience of both sides. Like, how do you balance that? It jumps out that you said to Niamh, we don't need to do that. because you know that it's like you can be there, rather than going,
that sounds fucking great,
let's do it. You're going, you know, it feels like you're going, I'll push you to where you need to be pushed, but we're not going to go past it.
Yeah.
We're going to look after the human as well.
Absolutely. As the actor. It's the most important thing, I think, for a director to be able to, you know, direct and navigate each actor individually, because every actor is different. As you know, everyone has their own process and their own way of working, and there's no rules in this game. So for me as a director, it's primarily my job to understand the person on a deep, deep level. And that just comes with talking to them and you know, hanging out with them and really sort of go into those places, you know, that can be uncomfortable at times, because you have to know the person on a deep level, like I say, and you know, and I have to become vulnerable myself, which, you know, is not easy at times, but you have to sort of go to that level sometimes and you know, cry with each other, laugh with each other, just be in each other's pockets as much as possible. And it's not always the case that you get that much time with someone, because there's a lot of pressure on shows to have time. So you have to sort of do that in your own time. And sometimes actors are busy on other shows or on other movies or whatever they're doing, you know, in their private lives. So it's finding that time is difficult sometimes, but it's integral to sort of get to know the person. But so then when you do get on set, I don't want to say it's easy, but it's not as stressful, because I know them so much that I can just say a word and just be like, no, Niamh, we're not going to do that, are we? We're not going to do that. And they'd be like, yeah, no, you're right, yeah. But actors, rightly so, are constantly, and you need to let actors be able to have their own minds and their own sort of, you know, ideas about certain scenes and certain character traits and things like that. It's always got to be a collaboration. But ultimately, like there's certain things that actors will do and I'll be like, we'll never see that. So, you know, don't go there, because it will be a waste and we'll never see it. So it's my job to sort of help the actors to understand when to go there and when not to go there. You know what I mean? Because, you know, if an actor's putting everything into a character and it's not showing on screen, because they're just, you know, they're sort of a little bit lost, if that makes sense. I mean, look, the whole method acting thing, I think it can be a very dangerous technique at times because, you know, I've never studied it intensely, but I know the sort of foundations is like to literally become that character and go out and do, you know, to a certain degree, you have to sort of research and do that type of thing. But, you know, if you're playing a homeless person, you don't want to go out and do your research, but don't put yourself out there in danger and stuff, not just physically, but mentally as well.
Yeah,
because, you know, you've got to look after yourself. And I have to look after the actor, not the actor, but the human. I have to look after the person.
It's a beautiful thing. And I think it's something I've learned since moving into the world of film and TV is realizing why you have these people who you're like, oh, they always work together, or they're always, they come in projects together all the time. It's like you realize it is about those relationships, and it can be an appreciation of their ability, but also an awareness that this is someone I can work with and I can communicate with and make sure we get the most of. And now I'm not going to kind of go into how we met in too much detail, just because I recorded with Stephen Ogg a couple of days ago, our mutual friend, and we had a great chat about that weekend away and all of this. But hearing you say all that, it just makes me a buzzing for some point down the line in 5 years or 10 years when we work together, because
we have cried together.
We have cried together. We have laughed together. It's all that stuff that you have those experiences where you go, right, this was for the experience, and then you realise, oh, this actually informs me for so much other stuff going forward. And me and Steve talked about a load of this kind of off podcast of how mad it is to the fact that, particularly with Steve, that's the only time I've ever met the dude. We had 2 days of meeting each other, yet because we can continue communicating and continue, I can be consuming more of his work and finding out more of him as an artist as well as a person. You've got this thing that's just ongoing. Yeah. It's fucking adorable.
It's amazing, like, because like what you said there that weekend, the way that we had, and it was just so powerful because you allow yourself to be vulnerable. And I think actors struggle with that at times, you know what I mean? Because you are putting yourself out there.
Particularly offset.
Offset, like the amount of times I've seen
actors, and there's that need to try and prove yourself.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're talking about what they've done or who they've worked with. And that comes up.
That comes up
in my conversations all the time. But you can tell when it is from that place of kind of insecurity to kind of go, no, I'm legit.
Yeah.
I'm proper. And that can be the only interaction that many people in this industry have.
Yeah.
It's like you're trying to walk away going, I held my own there.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, there was a connection.
Yeah, totally. You know? And it's such a difficult industry. It's not for the faint-hearted, you know what I mean? I've said this many times. I've done some workshops in the past with actors where I come in and sort of, we do some scenes and I, you know, we do some improv stuff together. And then I sort of sit and talk to them about my experience in the industry and whatnot. And I've had actors come up to me and go, you know, actors in their 50s or like later on in life, you know, they've had a full life and full career. And he said, I've wanted to do this for so many years. I did it when I was younger. And now I'm back. I'm going to do it again. And I'm ready for it this time. And I'm ready. And I'm going to smash it. So I've quit my job. I've done everything. And I'm like, no, don't do that. Because, you know, yes, that passion is absolutely, you know, you've got to have that passion, but ultimately you've got to be prepared for the knockbacks and the no's and, you know, a lot of rejection. And so, you know, have it there alongside your life and still, you can still be that passionate about it, but you still need to, you can't just go, I'm now going to be a star. And also the mentality for some people is in the wrong place, the motivation for why they want to do this. Like, you want to be famous. I want to be on TV. I ask people, like, why do you want to get into acting? Because I want to be on telly. Well, why do you want to be on telly? Because you want to be famous and you want to make loads of money. Well, you know, don't go and be on a reality show or something like that because
because
ultimately the motivation is in the wrong place.
Yeah, you know? Completely. I love hearing this. Me and a rapper who's one of my best friends now, B Dolan, have always talked about, there was particularly a time in the indie rap scene where it was very cool to say, quit your job and go 100% into this business and into this industry and whatever else. And that's such a blindsided thing. And I've always been really careful with my story, because my story was, I quit my job in HMV and kind of lived in my van for a year to get into music and make it work. But
and you did.
I did. But whilst I don't come from privilege, I did have a mum who had a bedroom for me.
Yes.
So I had these things that I can fall back on. And if you've not got that, say you've got a kid to support or you've got a family or you've got anything else,
right,
it's not a viable thing and it's not healthy for your idols to be going, if you really want it, go all in. Because I had a lot of luck in there as well. And I talk about this all the time. This podcast is what has allowed me to remain in this acting industry and to continue there.
Yeah.
Partly financially, but partly mentally.
Yeah, yeah.
Having something to focus on, having these conversations rather than waiting to hear back from self-tapes or waiting to get a fucking self-tape.
Yeah.
And this leads nicely on, because one of the biggest, again, probably the biggest thing that has kept me in this industry was the podcast I did with Stephen Graham just after I met Stevie on my third acting gig.
What was that? Taboo.
On Taboo.
Yeah.
And we'd exchange some messages back and forth in the past. I met him in the street once and he came up to me because he had my album. And I was like,
wow,
me and my mate had been going, Stephen Graham's coming up the street, play it cool. And he walked past and then he came back to say, oh, fuck.
Love that.
But in that podcast interview, he talked about how after This Is England, he didn't book a gig for 18 months. And Sophia Boutella had a similar story. And they were two of the biggest influences on my mental space when you have those periods. Because again, you do. Like after I had my biggest acting gig on this NBC show, it was at least 18 months until I booked another gig. Yeah. But I can sit there going, well, Stephen Graham's not shit. So he didn't not book for 18 months because he's shit. Therefore, I can tell myself it's not because I'm shit that no one's coming for me. It's just how the industry is sometimes. But I want to talk about you, how you and Stephen met, because I've not heard the story. I've always guessed it was on Band of Brothers because that's where you like you were both in that. Yeah. But I've never actually asked either of you or heard it. So tell me a bit about how you and Stephen met.
Well, it was exactly that. It was on Band of Brothers, but I've known of sort of him, you know, as a scouser in the industry. I knew he was sort of in the industry and whatnot. So I'd heard of him, and then when we were doing Band of Brothers, I remember the first day on set, we all sort of like got together, and all the cast were like, they'd all done a boot camp together. For 10 days, and I hadn't because I was working on another show called Dream Team, and I was finishing up on that.
Mate, just quickly, we're going to get into that, but that's what I love about this podcast, right? So I was going to do one with Jacob Tamuri, who's a mate, who's Tom Hardy's stuntman.
Yeah.
And when I was researching that, I saw that he was in The Tribe, which blew my mind. Wow. Do you remember The Tribe, the kids show? Like, he's this stuntman, but he was in that. Never mentions it because he's moved on. I loved Dream Team back in the day. And it was only when I was researching yesterday that I was like, fuck me, you were in Dream Team. This is amazing. So we'll get into that as well.
Man,
So you were off doing that when you booked Band of Brothers.
Yeah. I was doing that, booked Band of Brothers. And then I turned up on the first, like, I think it was a couple of days before we started shooting or something, like to get costume fittings and all that. And Steve was there. And I remember Lockstock was a massive, it was a huge, it was a huge success film. And he came on set and he was like, I've just wrapped on Snatch, this movie called Snatch, the next Guy Ritchie film. And I was like, oh, cool, cool, cool. Thinking it was just going to be like another little indie, you know, like another Guy Ritchie film. I was like, oh, he's in it. He's like, oh yeah, this is from Brad Pitt and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, fucking hell, mate. And we were the only two Scousers on this massive HBO miniseries, you know what I mean? And so we sort of connected in that way, really. And we became mates and we used to hang out. We all used to hang out together, you know what I mean? And then Steve left the show early because I did the full stint. I was in like till the end, but I think his character left like after episode 3 or 4 or whatever. So I remember him leaving and that. And he was living in London at the time. And we stayed in touch back and forth. We go for coffees now and again. And then we sort of lost touch because he was off doing his thing. That was it. I remember one time he messaged me. He called me up and I've said this to him before as well. And I remember where I was. I was about to go into an audition in Spotlight and I'm on the phone to him. And he's like, oh, I've got this thing that I'm, this amazing story that's happening, this script. It's not properly written yet. And we're going to do workshops with this new director called Shane Meadows. And it's all about skinheads in the 80s. He said, you'd be perfect for it. And I'm doing that. So let me have a word and stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, cool. Yeah, Sam. Next minute, you know what I mean? It's like, This Is England. And I was like, oh fuck. But
that would have been insane.
It wasn't saying I'll get your part in it.
I've got a mate who's just trying to get into the industry at the moment. And the main bit of advice I've given her is after these meetings go well, don't be ashamed to follow up. Because I've definitely had that. Because it's like, I'm not going to, if in that moment, Stevie would have, of course, meant that, thought you were perfect for it, but he's got a lot to deal with himself. It's not necessarily going to be a priority. And I've definitely had that in the past where I've had mates say, oh, yeah, we'll get you in this. And I've sat quietly.
Yeah.
And they've had a million other things to think about. Yeah. And what I should have done is given a little polite nudge and again, gone, hey, man, how's that project going?
Yeah.
Is there anything? And not be ashamed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
To go, I'd really love to work on this. I'm excited. You know, which I think there's a working class thing there that you don't want to feel like you're tapping anyone up for favors or you're getting any like a leg up that you shouldn't have. And you need to shed that and not be embarrassed to go, what's going on with that?
Yeah.
And again, I've missed numerous things because of not doing that in the past.
Because you're absolutely right. It's not like they're going, you know, as soon as we'll get you in that and then walk away and go, oh, no, there's no chance. It's like, it's
a million other,
million things, other things going on. And it's like, oh shit. Yeah. So definitely always follow up. Always follow up.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's how we met. And then actually, like, jumping forward, we sort of lost touch for a bit because he was obviously off doing his thing, and I was obviously following his success. I'm very, very proud. And we got back in touch again because my mum had passed away 7 years ago now. And for some reason, I just got in touch with him, and, you know, I'd been sober a year, been sober 8 years now, but like something just sort of, for some reason we got in touch, and we ended up becoming really close, you know, because, you know, Stevie, he is just a beautiful human being. And so, you know, I felt like I could talk to him a bit because, you know, you're talking to your family about the loss of your mum and all that, and everyone's in at the same time. And I didn't really have anyone else I could sort of speak to about it. And I felt like Stevie was someone who I could really sort of open up to a little bit, you know.
He's got that air about him, not to make this the Stephen Graham appreciation podcast,
yeah,
which it regularly is, but yeah, the reason I came on that weekend was he reached out the blue, mm, and was just like, how you doing? And I was in a bad way.
Yeah.
And it was, I felt comfortable saying, you know what, actually, I'm not doing good, mate, mm, kind of thing. Mm. And he was instantly, I'm arranging this thing, come along. And yeah, again, that just, yeah, it speaks of who he is. But
yeah,
so you kept in touch. And then I guess a boiling point,
well,
came about.
Yeah, it was more, so I decided I wanted, well, after my mum passed away, I was like, I want to pursue this career as a director. I want to try it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I got this script, this beautiful short film, 10 pages long, about a young boxer who was suffering with mental health. Mm-hmm. And so I spoke to Robbie, who wrote it and who played the lead in it. And at first he was like, but you've never directed anything before. And I was like, I know, but this is, I would love to start it with this film if we could, you know, anyway. Mm-hmm. And like, I think 6 months went by and then he ended up saying, okay, let's do it, you know. And then we got it made. But one of the first things I wanted to do, I called Stevie up and I was like, I want you to play I'd love you to play the boxing trainer. And it's only like a couple of scenes, it's a tiny little thing. It'll be like half a day's work. And he was just like, he said something along the lines of, why don't we see how you get on with this film? And then we'll have a chat if you want to do any more, or, you know, we can see. Let's see how you get on. Let's see.
I love it.
And you know, at the time I was like a bit gutted because I thought, oh, he's me mate. He's going to come in me film, isn't he? But he's not. He's Stephen Graham, and he's not going to just put himself in anything. Yeah. You know what I mean? So So it was a case of just being like, okay. So we made the film, and we ended up getting a real boxing trainer in the end, and it was brilliant, and I really enjoyed the process. And that was, I was like, this is exactly what I want to do now. It was sort of the thing. And so I sent Steve the short, and he just got in touch. He was like, mate, this is beautiful. He said, so what are you going to do next? You want to do more? I said, well, I know I need to get an agent to enable me to be able to do this professionally. Mm-hmm. I know that, because I can't just do it off my own back. I know I need to get an agent because I've been in the industry for 20 odd years. I knew the ins and outs and I knew how it all worked. You know what I mean? So then he was like, okay, what are you thinking next? So I'd had the idea to do Boiling Point because I'd worked in kitchens for 12 years while I was still trying to, you know, my acting career went up down the pan a little bit because of my addictions and, you know, and all that kind of stuff and the sort of dark hole that I was in. But so I needed to make some money anyway. That world was like mad. And I just thought, it's never really been documented properly, in my opinion, what I've experienced. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's been other movies and things like that in the past where it's been quite glorified.
The high-end version of it.
Exactly that,
right.
Yeah.
The very shiny look at this artistry rather than look at the pressure.
Exactly.
And like I worked in a Pizza Hut kitchen, so I'm not talking a big-time kitchen, but even that, it was like, it's this constant turnover to be doing everything and keep this standard, the slightest drop in standard and the general public are down your throat on your case. And it's like not realizing that in that job, I'm on minimum wage.
Yeah.
I'm head of the kitchen. So I'm running all of it. And that was when I was like 18 or 19.
Yeah.
It was mad.
Yeah.
It was the genuine, again, the lucky thing for me was it was somewhere like Pizza Hut. So when I clocked off, I clocked off. It wasn't somewhere that was my restaurant or my passion or my career even.
Yeah.
But those hours I was there
were
fucking heart racing,
heat
literally through the roof and, orders flying through. So it's intense.
It's like nothing else, you know what I mean? I always say to people, like, do a shift in a kitchen and you'll you know, it'll make you think about...
You'll be humbled.
You'll be humbled, yeah.
100%.
But so I just, you know, I pitched them the idea for this short, about a chef who's struggling with his addictions, and told him that we'd like to sort of try and shoot it all in one, because it will keep the focus on this person and you won't be able to take your eyes off them. And I sort of loosely pitched it to him, thinking I'd love to ask him again to be in it, to play the lead. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, he would be my number one choice, but I'd been burnt a little bit by his response to the first shot. So I was a bit nervous, you know what I mean? So I didn't really say to him. And then after the pitch, it wasn't even a pitch. I wouldn't go in there going, right, let me pitch you this. It was more like, he asked me, what do you want to do next? And I said, well, there's this thing I've got an idea for and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, mate, so you're going to play the character, right? I was like, not really. No, I don't want to do both. I want to get someone in who can do that, and I'll sort of focus on the directing side of it. And he was like, well, when are you looking to do it? I said, well, whenever we get that person on board, you know what I mean? And in mind, I'm going, come on, please say so, please. And then in the back of my mind, I'm going, just ask him now. Now's the right time. And before I was going to ask him, he just said to me, right, well, I think I'm free in December if you'll have me. I'd love to do it. I was like, oh my God. Really? Would you want to do it? And so we scrambled to get the script written and just got, and this was like, I think it was October when I sort of was on the phone to him. And then we just got it ready and got it made, you know what I mean? Because as soon as he's on board, that was it. It was easy to sort of get the money together. I think it was 10 grand we made it for, or something like that. But, and no one, you know, it all went on equipment and the hire of the catering college that we used. But yeah, and from then, you know, he was so on board with me. And then the whole agent thing, me getting an agent, I remember on the last day of the shoot, we filmed it on the Sunday. We rehearsed it on the Friday, Saturday, and then we shot it on the Sunday in Manchester. And he was like, right, let's get you that agent then. And so, and I didn't think anything of it, because I just thought, I probably have to call him up in 6 months and be like, did you manage to maybe send it out? And I was prepared to send it out to agents myself anyway. And I think it was probably, we'd finished the film, all the sound design, everything was done. And maybe it took a good couple of months or whatever. I sent him the film, he loved it. And then within about a week, I had a phone call from an agent to independent, Jago Irwin, who's still my agent now, called me up and went, I've just been sent this movie. I hope you don't mind. I've been sent you a short film, and I think it's one of the best shorts I've ever seen. And would you be interested in coming in and having a chat about representation? And I was like, oh my God. And so that's, I got my agent, you know what I mean? Off the back of that. And thanks to Steve.
I love it. And this is the point where I'm going to try and rein in my excitement, but I want to talk to you about one-shots and the art of the one-shot. I'm a huge fan of them. Like, three or four of the music videos I've directed have been one-shots. And because of that, I've like hosted the one-shot short film awards in the past at the Prince Charles Cinema and all that. I just think there's such an exciting thing. So like Russian Ark is insane.
Yeah.
Victoria, I think, is one of the best films ever made.
Me too.
So let's get into it.
What
is it about one-shots that you enjoy? And what is it that made you feel it worked right for this, I guess? Because again, to be clear to anyone who doesn't know, the short was a one-shot, and then that became a film that was a one-shot. Mm-hmm, that's this huge ballet of a movie. And what is it about that format?
I think, like, with the short, I'd said to my cinematographer, Matt Lewis, who's been my cinematographer and everything I've done, I remember being in Lithuania, in a hotel. I was doing an acting gig in Lithuania, and I'd written down, we were sort of writing the script or whatever, and I said to Matt, you know, it needs to feel real, it needs to feel fast-paced, visceral, overlapping dialogue, you know, constant, like, but keeping the focus on Stephen, you know what I mean? And he was just like, why don't we just do it all in one? And I was like, oh my God. And then as soon as he said it, it's just, my head just went boom. And I was like, I visualized the whole thing. I mapped it all out in my head. And it was like, okay. But one of the things I didn't want it to be is a gimmick. You know what I mean? And I was like, well, look, if we're going to do it, we need to do it and make it, you know, not feel like we're trying to be clever. It has to add
to being a reason for it. Yeah.
Totally. It has to add to the process and the story and everything, and not be the main focus. And the trick was to, you know, obviously it's advertised as a one-hour and stuff like that, but you know, the trick is to make the audience forget that after the first 5 minutes and just be on this this roller coaster, you know. And so we did it with the short, and it was you know, it was a success. And so when we sort of were talking about doing a feature length version of Boiling Point, one of the first ideas was to actually have the short as the opening of the feature. So 20 minutes, the first 20 minutes would be a oneer, mm-hmm. and then we'd cut, and then we'd go into the sort of recovery of Andy and him trying to get himself back on track, et cetera, et cetera. But the more we were going through it and trying to develop that, it was like, oh, it just doesn't feel like mm. what we felt when we were doing the short. And then one day I was just sat up in bed. I think I was shooting Villain, my first feature. And I sat up and I just was like, I remember I'd worked in one of my good mates, Andy Jones. He's got a restaurant in Dalston called Jones and Sons, which is where we shot the movie. And I was just like, I'd worked there loads and loads of times. Like, I'd worked there as a chef. So I knew the place inside out. And I was like, if we were to do the feature in Wanted, if we could do it there in that restaurant, then I closed my eyes and I was like mapping it out and going, we could do this and then that. And we could go out the back and it would all work. Logistically, it would work. So I called James, the co-writer, and I was like, I've got this idea, blah, blah, blah. And he got excited. And then Matt, I called Matt Lewis. Then Matt got excited because he's so ambitious and so like driven, you know what I mean? I was like, do you think you could do it? He's like, fucking right, yeah, could, yeah. And he's young, you know what I mean? So he's fit and young, and he's ready to go. And
again, then he's another one that Stevie has spoken highly of, because he's like, the lad's just up for it. The lad's got all the skill and talent, but he's also just fucking up for it, and that makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But then obviously I had to call Stevie and be like, listen, we're thinking about doing the feature. He's like, why would you want to do that? You got your agent now, haven't you? I was like, well, I just think it could be really cool and like, you know, yeah, I think it would be great. And he was like, right. I said, then we're going to try and do it all in one. And he just immediately was like, well, the fucking short was an absolute buzz. So to do it. Yeah. And he got nervous. He got excited. And that was the feeling that everyone was getting about doing it in one shot. And you know, when you just know it's right, the right thing to do when everyone's having the same reaction to it. And so we went into it again with that same sort of feeling that we didn't want this to be a gimmick, and because we're going to be longer now. And Victoria was the one thing that made me go, this can be done. It can be 100% done. Russian Ark was another one, obviously, but Victoria was the one for me because it's like...
I completely agree, because Russian Ark is one that I referenced, but I'm like, it is a chore in places.
Yes.
Whereas Victoria, you just got that energy. It's the energy of a night out. And when she does that performance on the piano,
oh my God.
You're just like this... Number one, I'm not thinking of a one shot anymore. But number two, I'm not thinking this is a film anymore.
Exactly.
I'm just in this, and it's just so, yeah.
I remember the fact that I held my breath for the majority of that film, and I just remember the feeling that it gave me.
Yeah.
And that was what we wanted to recreate in this kitchen environment, you know what I mean? And so we went at it with, like, you know, the idea of choreographing it, and we went to town with it, and we ended up getting the restaurant. My mate Andy was like, yeah, of course you can have the restaurant. So we paid him to sort of shut it down for 3 weeks while we rehearsed and did all that. And it was a case of sort of choreographing the moves and choreographing the camera. And so one of the rules that we gave ourselves in the short film was the camera never leaves Stephen. It's always on Stephen. And so he motivates where the camera goes. And it was all choreographed, obviously, but it never leaves Stephen. So with the feature, it was like, that would be amazing. And of course, we want to see Stephen Graham for 90 minutes. But we also want to explore other characters. And because he's the head chef, he can't just keep coming out of the kitchen, even though he does a few times. But if we want him to go to different rooms and different places, we need to be on outside. We can't just be going with Stephen. So the rules that we gave ourselves, two rules that we gave ourselves on the feature was, the camera's always motivated by an actor, and it's never allowed to just float off on its own and find an actor. It always has to be motivated. So crossover, actors crossing each other, or, you know, handing a plate or whatever it was going to be. And then the second rule was that we never repeat a camera move. So even though the camera is essentially going backwards and forwards through the restaurant, the actual movement and the positioning of the lens and things like that was never repeated.
Amazing.
Twice. So it was about Matt and I, and we drew it all out, and we sort of did an animation of where the cameras were going to go. And then I would bring the actors in individually and place them where we needed them to be. But initially it was me running around playing all the roles, and Matt just following me and go, okay, so let's go around this side when they get to here. And then, so it was like really mapped out before the actors came on set. And then the actors, I would say, right, you're going to be there, you're going to be there, you're going to be there. And then when the camera comes around here, you're going to come over there. So it's like a dance, you know, it's like choreographing a dance or a piece of your ballet or play. Do you know what I mean? So
completely understand. And I love it, because I think when finding your voice as a director your first instinct is to go, I love Shea Meadows. I want to make Shea Meadows films. Yeah. I love this. I love that. But it's finding how your brain works. And that was it for this. Hearing you say that I'm running around, I'm playing all of it. And it's like, at that point, no one else could have stepped in and directed this because it's all in your head. No one, no one knows it. It has to be you.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely key, is finding those things that play to how your brain works.
Yeah.
That you're pushing yourself, but also it's playing to the uniqueness of your brain, of your thought patterns, of all of this thing. And then that's where it all comes out. And I want to, I mean, obviously we're going to talk about the series.
Yeah.
I want to jump into that now because I was nervous about the series because I love the short and the film so much. Both of them, Stevie sent to me early and I was like, they're the reason I now have screen sharing from my phone to my TV, because he'd sent them to me, but it's only as a file. And I was I can't watch these on my phone. I know it's going to be a work of art. So I had to figure out all this stuff and at that point download an extra app because I'm like, I want to watch it properly. I don't just want to go, all right, cool. But, you know, I wanted to take it in. But I loved them both. I didn't know how it was going to translate into a series. And I've seen the first two episodes.
Yeah.
And I fucking adore the choices that you've made because I feel, if it had been a one shot per episode, it would have felt like a gimmick. As beautiful as it would have been and as wonderful as you would have done it, it would have felt like a gimmick.
Mm.
So what I saw was a beautiful homage to the one shot in the opening scene, the pre-credit scene, and then revealing to the public that it was never the one shot that made it exciting. It was the speaking over each other. It was the stepping on each other's lines. It was the hecticness. Yep. So that energy is still all there. I finished the second episode. I was saying to Stephen Ogg, I was like, I was in awe. And then I was like, I want to see these scripts because surely so much of this has to be improvised, you had to have given the actors so much control over their characters and their dialogue because there's so much. Like you couldn't be able to go, and at this point that word overlaps that, and you, it's like, no, you fucking, you're having an argument, so you have an argument. And it's got that, and it's so beautiful. Even just said, even after the first episode, it was so beautiful to go, people are going to watch this who loved Boiling Point and thought they loved it because it's a one shot, because it's this and that, and realize they loved it because of the characters, because of the way it's, the freedom in the performances. And it was like, it's a buzz, man. You guys have nailed it. It's exciting.
That means the world, man, because that was what you just said there is exactly what we wanted to achieve with this. You know what I mean? Because there was a point when BBC were like, we think we should do a one take episode, or, you know, at least do the first episode or the last episode as one take, or do the whole thing as one take. Could we do that? And I'm like, no, because we've done it and we can pay homage to it. And the idea was always to sort of open it with a oner. And originally, actually, because we reshot that one take because we'd shot the one take on the very first day of the shoot. And in the script, it was 4 minutes. It was about 4 minutes long. We timed it. And when we got into the edit, because I directed the first two episodes and then we had Munya Ackle come in and direct the other two. While she was shooting her block and I was in the edit with my stuff, we quickly realized that the 4 minutes wasn't long enough and we'd wanted to push it further. So we actually shot that one take on the very last day of the whole production.
Oh, really?
And actually it was like organically the best choice, because now all these characters and all these actors, are so close with each other that those sort of organic improv moments that we put in there just became so real and so natural to their characters, you know what I mean?
Because that's the truth of Kitchens as well, is you do very quickly love and very genuinely love and very genuinely hate each other.
Yes.
Like, all at once. Yeah. It's very, all of the love is real, but all of the vitriol is as real as anything.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And that all comes across. And speaking of your cast, someone that jumped out to me, who I've not seen in much, was Sean Fagan. Oh, I just thought, he's just astounding. Obviously, he was in Malpractice, right?
And
he was just amazing. But I'm a big fan of Azuka Hoyle.
Yeah.
Big Boys was one of my shows of the year last year, and that was the first time I was exposed to how amazing she is.
Yeah.
And then as I said, I sent a message as soon as I finished it to our mutual friend Hannah Graham, because episode two, you put her to work.
Yeah.
Like, that's a hell of a, everyone in it has got, it's a big one, but it was, I thought, so many people, and that's not to mention Vinette and Stevie and Stephen and all of these other amazing people. But that's what's always exciting for me is going, I'm here because I'm excited about these people.
Yeah.
And you're going, and again, that's another thing that I think comes across in this is these two episodes I've seen also show you that you thought you loved Boiling Point because quite rightfully you love Stephen Graham.
Yeah.
But actually, as you said, it's all the characters.
Yeah.
The fact that in the film you chose to go away from just sticking on Stevie and go off meant we've got to know all these characters and they're also...
Yeah. Rich. I mean, that was a choice from Stephen himself, actually, and all of us, you know what I mean? Obviously, the BBC, because at the end of the movie, a lot of people would come up to me and go, is he dead or alive? And I'm like, well, it's up to your interpretation. That was the whole idea, was to leave it open for you guys to figure it out yourselves, or, you know, your interpretation, of course. When the BBC were like, do you think Stephen would come back? Do you think he's alive? And I'm like, oh, yeah, he's alive. Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
But Stevie was like, he was well up for it, but he said, look, I want to pass the baton on to, you know, Vinette and all of these other characters and brand new characters that we want to bring in. And, you know, that's the type of person he is. And this is becoming the Stevie Graham Appreciation Society, hasn't it? But rightly so, though, because he is just an amazing human being. But what we said was, we were like, and we said this to the BBC, we'll create a storyline for Andy. And if you were to condense all of his scenes together, it would be a beautiful short film about a guy who's, you know, recovering and, you know, trying to get his life back on track. And that was what we've peppered through the series. So, you know, it was a challenge, I guess, to, you know, back and forth with the BBC, because Stephen's not in it as the lead. You got Vinette, who's obviously, you know, she's successful from the film and she's done some amazing TV since that, but she's not like a big, big name to lead a show. And we were just like, this is an ensemble, but, you know, this is not a show that needs big, big names to be able to draw people to it. You know what I mean? I think it'll either be like a word of mouth thing, or, you know, if people have seen the film, they'll be interested in coming back to see what happens with these characters.
Yeah.
And so that was always the idea, is to create this ensemble family that people can relate to, and bringing people like Sean Fagan, who I think is destined for absolute greatness, because he's just incredible.
Yeah, I think absolutely astounding. It didn't feel like an actor or a character or anything.
No.
It was just a real thing. And it's interesting, because not to over intellectualize, but you do get restaurants where it's Gordon Ramsay's restaurant or whatever, and the chef is the lead. But you get far more restaurants where the food is the lead, is the star. And that's what this show is. Boiling Point is the lead. The show, the ensemble, it's not about here's our famous chef.
Yeah.
It's about here's what we're putting on your table kind of thing.
And
it works beautifully.
And I think like looking... You know, I've said this to a few people, like, I think it feels like a second season of something because of the film, you know, because people can come back to these characters again. And that was the idea, to explore those characters further, because, you know, a lot of people would come up to me and be like, oh my God, I wish you'd have held on that moment for longer. I wish I'd have found out what was going on with that person. I wish I'd have found out, you know, maybe gone to see how they were doing a bit later on, and now we can do that. You know what I mean? But at the same time, I don't want every sort of person and storyline to be tied up in a neat little bow, because that's not what life's about, you know?
And again, I like that there's no, because again, I'm getting too deep into the, I've worked in kitchens, but I like that there's not origin stories kind of thing straight away for any of the new characters. Everyone's just thrown in there. Cause again, that's how it is. You are just thrown in and it is just, here's who's in there. I'm conscious of time, and there's so much I want to talk about. But one of the things I did want to talk about is your production company, essentially, because I love when people fight for years to get a seat at the table and then they smash their seat up to make their own table and to give other people a seat at the table.
I love
and
that.
It feels like what you guys have done here. And again, I remember speaking to Stevie on Venom 2. So just as him and Hannah were talking to me about setting up Matriarch and about Boiling Point and all of this. So tell me a little bit about how it all came about and what the production company is and what your kind of excitement is with that and drive there. Because again, you could just go, I've had these successes. As Stevie said, you've got your agent now. Get on with it kind of thing. But you've not.
I'm not part of Matriarch.
Of course. So that's what they were setting up at the time.
Yeah, so they've set up theirs and I just thought to myself, exactly what you just said there. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, I suddenly realized that, like, all of these people that I put on a pedestal and like was scared to approach, you know, all these people at the top, they're just human beings, and like everyone's blagging it. You know what I mean? Everyone has imposter syndrome, all that kind of stuff. And so I didn't set up the production company to create more jobs for myself or to, you know, for me to direct stuff. Cause you know, I'm getting offered stuff from, and I also didn't want to close off the doors for people sending me scripts from other production companies as well. Mm-hmm. So the idea to set up the production company was to give people the opportunity, you know, that they may not get, you know, we're approachable, you know what I mean? And that's the ethos, is that we're approachable and we want to make things accessible for brand new directors, brand new writers, and give them the opportunity to sort of get their foot in the door, you know what I mean? And I think, you know, all the projects that we do going forward, we want to bring on people who wouldn't necessarily, you know, get that opportunity. And we want to create stories that really stick with people and, you know, and take people on a journey. Personally, I think over the last couple of years, like, I'm starting to find my voice, I think, and it's the real stories, like realism, you know, and that sort of the tension and the sort of, you know, anxiety inducing films and TV.
Oh, we're going to be getting on to Accused. Yeah. Don't worry about that. Yeah. That's the ultimate tension and anxiety inducing. But mate, I couldn't relate more to everything you're saying there. In 2011, I started up my record label, Speech Development, and our slogan is, "We may not be for you, and that's fine." And the point of that was, the first album we released was mine. Straight after that, we released an album by a guy called Giacomo Brown. Mm. And it was because me and Dan Lissac had heard their stuff. I do have a personal connection, but me and Dan Lissac had heard their stuff. And we were like, right, well, this music is amazing, but this person has no desire to play live, has no desire to do interviews, basically has no desire to be a musician as a career.
Yeah.
But this music is amazing. So we were like, no one else would release this. Right. Originally, me and Dan were going to be getting an imprint on another label. So it was our first kind of, if we get the chance, we want to release this because no other label will release it because marketing-wise, it's really hard to push and really hard to sell. But we were just like, but if marketing didn't exist, if we lived in a world where art was art rather than a product, this would be the first on people's list because it was amazing. And that was the first album we put out other than mine. And it got like a 4 out of 5 in Uncut magazine and like Six Music rated it and stuff like that. And it was this album that just appeared and then disappeared because, as I said, no desire to make a career of it. It was just, I've got some songs. And that was exactly our thing. We were like, and we did numerous ones like that we're like, this isn't like a few guys who were on an indie in America that I was a fan of. I'm like, well, no label over here is going to release their record because it's already available in America. Mm. They can't come over here and promote it easily. You know, they might be able to come over once a year if that, but it's good music. And we live in a world where there's a big area of, like, I know me growing up, I couldn't afford imported CDs. I couldn't afford to pay charges to get this brought in. So it's like, if I can produce it cheap in the UK and put it out so people can have it, then it works. And that was the exact, again, it's that exact ethos of going, this probably wouldn't get in people's ears if we don't do something here.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's why we need to do it. That's the only reason to have this label is to,
amazing,
to make
man.
That happen.
It's amazing. I love that. And that's the thing, is like me growing up as a kid, you know what I mean? When I was trying to get into the industry as an actor, I didn't feel like anything like that was accessible. And believe me, I did look, like I did search for it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in actual fact, it is. And you know, you don't have to have come from a privileged background or have gone to film school or, you know, anything like that, or gone to drama school. Try and get yourself out there and just get those opportunities. And that's what we want to sort of help create. If you've got a good voice, if you've got a voice or you've got stories to tell which are good, then we can hopefully help to get those off the ground. You know what I mean?
If anyone's listening to this who hasn't listened to my episode I did with Jack Spring, go and listen to that because he's a big inspiration to me. I said he was the youngest director in the UK. He made his first feature film at 19 and he's a working class lad and he didn't do it with any industry money. He just hustled and made it happen. And he's been helping me a lot with my projects because he was like, working class people don't realise that even if you've got that dream, you think that it's, I'll take it to Warner Brothers and either they'll let me make it or they won't. And he's like, that's one option.
Yeah.
But
there's
also options outside of that and outside of industry money and outside of this. And it's like, yeah, That's fucking, it's an inspiration. And I love that. So tell people the name of your production company anyway, just so if there is anyone who wants to hassle
it's,
you.
It's called, it's feel free. Honestly, it's called It's All Made Up Productions. And I mean, just, you know, this is another thing as well. There's no rules, right, in this game. There's no right or wrong way of doing things. People think there is.
It is all made up,
People think there is, and it's there's not. You find your way of doing it. Find your path and find your way. And if it works for you, fucking brilliant. Just keep doing that.
I've got a good mate who I work on some scripts with sometimes because he's got one of the best minds. But one of the things I drill into him is the reason some of my scripts have got hype and excitement is because of the hype and excitement I'm putting in, not I've done 8 courses on script writing. I've done stuff, I've learned stuff, but again, at points, my mate is so, I read his scripts and I'm like, that doesn't sound like you. That sounds like you've really reined yourself into these really strict framework. And I think all frameworks are essential to learn so that you can subvert them if you choose to or if you need to.
Yeah.
And I get that energy and excitement across.
I think learn about final draft and how a script is formatted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the sort of like stage directions and all of those, the different actions and the dialogue. Learn how to do that, but then just write from the heart and you know, and just put you on a page if you're writing, do you know what I mean? And have your voice because that's what will stand out. You'll see lots of scripts which are all very, very similar and very the same either way they're written. But, you know, when you're reading a script and you feel like the characters are next year. You know what I mean? And you're in that world and you can feel yourself being immersed in it. That's when it's so beautiful.
I've just got to give a quick shout out because I'm a fade-in boy, not a final draft boy, but, you know, other script writing programs are available.
There are. Yeah. And there's Cell Text as well as another one.
There's loads of good ones. Well, again, before we start to wrap up, I want to talk about Accused because I think it's such a great, simple concept and relatable concept. Mm-hmm. It's about someone who is wrongly accused of a terrorist attack, essentially.
Yeah.
And then it's looking at how we react to things, I guess. I think it's commenting on social media.
Yeah.
It's commenting on everyone instantly thinking they know the full story and wanting to react immediately. Mm. How was that? Like, where did that film come from? How was it to... Because again, it's essentially, it's a project of building tension and then relieving it a bit and then building more and then relieving it a bit and kind of going on that journey. It's a real, there's a discipline there, but it's really, it builds and builds. And how was that to?
Well, I think ultimately, like, and you know, the film is about the social media culture and being wrongly accused and how powerful the social media and the internet is in those situations and how things can turn so quickly against someone. And it suddenly becomes from being an accusation to being true in inverted commas. Yeah. So, you know, it's in terms of like the sort of tension in that, it all stems from the realism and the believability of that can happen to any of us, you know what I mean? Mm. And it came about because James Cummings, who I co-wrote Boiling Point with, had written this script with another co-writer of his, Barnaby Bolton, who's a really good friend of mine as well. Mm-hmm. And they sort of sent us the script and we were back and forth developing it. And it was something that we were going to shoot during COVID, to be honest, because it was like just something to do and we were going to shoot it for quite cheap.
It's literally an isolation film. It's a dude essentially in a house scared.
Exactly that. And so then we sort of, you know, we got Chenille on board and we sort of went away and made this film. But it stems from the Boston bombings was one of the inspirations to do the film and the sort of, I've forgotten his name now, but there is a documentary about him. And the guy basically got wrongly accused of the bombings in Boston. And there was this whole online search and he ended up...
And the speed with which patriotism turns into violence.
Exactly.
Justice turns into,
And it happened overnight, same as what happens in our film, you know. Mm. And so it was about that sort of, I wanted people to sort of watch this film in their house and feel like they had to sort of close the doors. It's not a horror film, but it is sort of, it is horror. It's horrible. Mm.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It is somewhere between a thriller and a horror because I do think we're in a really interesting, and this is going off on a slight tangent, I think we're in a really interesting time for horror films because there's really good stuff being made that is on the side of realism horror.
Yeah.
So genuine threat that makes you scared, and all the monster stuff and supernatural stuff. I think there's really good, interesting stuff. And this sits somewhere in that because it is that, that home invasion horror kind of genre in a way, but it's so realism influence kind of thing. It's going, no, this is a comment on society.
Yeah.
And society happens to be a horror at the moment.
Exactly.
The genre is horror because the genre of society currently is horror.
Yeah. You know, I've had so many messages from the film because it got released on Netflix, and, you know, Netflix were just going to put it out, and they weren't going to really do any sort of press with it because it's not a Netflix original. So I just thought, oh, do you know what? It'll be on there. Maybe someone will see it. Maybe they won't, but that's fine, you know. And the next minute, it's just absolutely blown up. It's
say the word straight to number one. I know you're too humble. Say the word straight to number. Yeah,
it did go straight to number one. Yeah,
it did. Yeah, it's fucking mad, right?
And not only in the UK, it went to you know, it was in the top five, I think, in all the other territories that it's in on Netflix, like Canada and Australia and stuff.
Yeah,
and you know, they're talking about now potentially doing it as a, you know, not a remake, but in different countries, because it's so relatable all over the world. You know, it's, yes, it's set in the UK, but it's completely global issue.
It's one of the things I really like about Netflix, and there's a lot I like about Netflix. There's a lot I question about Netflix. Yeah. A lot of that is hopefully being solved at the moment with the strikes
and
the continued actions. But the writers' strike is now over, so these...
Yeah.
Things like this can be talked about a bit more.
Exactly.
With yourself and promoted. But I love that they're one of the first truly global companies in film and TV. Obviously, there's always been companies that release all over the world, but Netflix can go. Because they've had things like Money Heist and Squid Games become the big thing, they've got this kind of, oh, right, we can get English-speaking countries to watch non-English stuff, and we can get non-English-speaking countries to watch the English stuff. And it's this big, there's this meld. They've got such an opportunity to, and this, again, I do think they're doing a good job of realising and actualising that, of going, right, this is... The world is the market rather than North America or England or whatever else. Yeah. I love that shit. But again, I loved it. I think it's fantastic. I want to know, I know we moved on from Boiling Point, but what's the plan with Boiling Point? I don't know how it ends. So is there a plan for a second series, or what's the...
Well, I mean, there's always the hope that it will get a second series. We're really, really hopeful for it, and we've kind of left it open to it, but you know, you just never know with these things. It's all about the numbers and the figures, I guess, you know what I mean, and how well it does. That's just the sort of BBC and the terrestrial way, I guess.
Yeah.
It's all well and good getting great reviews and people saying they enjoyed it, but I think, you know, ultimately the population need to get behind it and watch it in order for it to get a second season. But yeah, I mean, we've got like a bottomless pit of ideas of what we would love to do for season two, season three, season four, you know what I mean? Mm. And it's got the opportunity to run because it's essentially a workplace drama. And the thing about the hospitality world and the kitchens is staff come and go all the time. So
I was going to say,
you know,
one of the reasons Game of Thrones is one of the great series is because you could kill people off whenever you wanted, and it was this exciting thing. Again, that's kitchens.
Yeah. And they did kill
people are killed off constantly. People go, new people come. So you can have this good turnover of fresh new characters, and you can move people in and out. Again, I'd imagine they're some of the scariest shows to work on, because you're relying on your wage and then you get the next series script. It's like, oh, I thought I was the lead. Turns out I'm dead, kind of thing. It could be really natural in those things, but that's what's exciting about them, right?
Yeah.
It's exciting to have those turnovers. Oh, before we wrap things up, you mentioned earlier people who say they want to get into TV because they want to be on TV and having the wrong motivations. How do you feel about reviews and viewing figures and that kind of thing? Because I don't believe they're the reason that we should be making these things, but I think they do. I think it's also sometimes a lie to say that you don't care about them, because you do want people to enjoy the shit you made. You do want, you want people to understand it.
Yeah.
You want people to get what you've intended to do. So, for example, when the Boiling Point reviews and the Accused reviews are starting to come in and they're amazing, it must be, you know, again, it shouldn't be the priority, but it's a lie to say it's not important, right?
Oh, it is. It's massively important because, you know, ultimately that's the first port of call for people to go, oh, it's got you know, 4 stars. Mm. Even 3 stars. It's got 3 stars. It must be, you know, good. So I'll check it out, yeah. You know. And so it is important. But, you know, obviously you find it's inevitable that you're not going to look at them because people send you them on WhatsApp or whatever and you're like, oh, yeah. And you're like, oh, God. But it's incredibly nerve-wracking. And I tell you what I always say it feels like to me. I've got a daughter, right, 6-year-old daughter, and she goes to, like, dance classes and stuff like that. And, you know, I think she's amazing. I think she's the best in the class. Of course I do. And then, you know, they do a show every year at the dance classes. And like you go off and watch the show and like you're watching the show with all these other parents and you're like, oh, I think she's the best. But then you like suddenly think, oh, but what if they don't think she's the best? Yeah. Oh God. Oh no. Now it's on show and it's like now we've got to put it out there to the world. And I think it's great, but like, I'm very proud of it, but shit.
And again, you realize that you've got all these. I've definitely had projects before. I've had projects that are coming out and I'm like, I can't wait. I know this is amazing. I don't care what reviews are. But I've had other projects where like, I think this is really good, but I can't tell anymore because I'm so connected to everyone involved in it that there's such a personal thing that I'm like, I'm loving every nuance because these people mean so much to me. Is that only me?
Yeah.
And more often than not, it comes across to everyone and it's this beautiful thing. But I've definitely had that where I'm like, I don't know if it's good or not. I think it is. I loved it.
I mean, it's. Is it? I suffer with imposter syndrome as I'm sure you do, and as I'm sure most people do in sort of any creative job. But like, because you're putting yourself out there all the time, and you know, you've got to believe in what you're doing, and ultimately, you've got to sort of enjoy it. And I think if you're not enjoying it, then that's the energy that you're putting out there. You know what I mean? As well.
I just want to quickly give you because I feel I solved imposter syndrome.
Oh,
I mentioned
it
once or twice on the podcast, but no, my big thing has been because imposter syndrome is feeling I don't deserve to be here. I'm not meant to be here, right?
Well,
where I'm from, I still live in the same small town I've always lived with no contacts or with a fucking stutter. I'm definitely not meant to be here. So now I can just enjoy it because it's mad that I am and it's mad that I keep getting to do this. It's like there was a point where I was like, no, it's no longer a doubt on if I'm meant to be here or not. I'm not. I've already exceeded what I'm meant to have done. So now, like, it's why me and Stevie hit it off because I was just every day on set of Taboo. I've told this story a million times, but they'd rap me and I'd be like, is it all right if I stay and watch?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm buzzed to be here. I'm learning. Yeah, I'm learning off these people. It's like, I don't want to go and sit in a hotel room on my own.
Yeah.
It's like, I shouldn't get to be on set with Tom Hardy and Stephen Graham. So while it's happening, I'm going to make the most of it.
Yeah.
And see, that's genuinely been my seemingly solution for imposter syndrome is long ago accepting, oh no, I've definitely not meant to be here.
Mm.
But I am.
So
fucking enjoy it. It's like a buffet you weren't invited to. you're not in this stuff in your face going, I'm not meant to be here. You're going, I'm not meant to fucking be here. How is this? So it's switching the tone of your I'm not meant to be here, I think is...
I fucking love that. I love that.
But yeah, well, I mean, to wrap things up, I know this is always a tough question for anyone in this industry, but what is ahead that you can talk about publicly, if anything? Or is it just boiling point is this? Here we are.
I mean, it was... that has been all consuming since, you know, last year, but I've got the production companies, obviously we've got a bunch of things that we're working on with that. I've got something that I'm starting in January, which I can't really say anything about just yet, but that's a sort of a big thing. And then, towards the end of next year, there's, you know, let's see where we are with Boiling Point season 2. And then again, a few films that I'm working on, but I'm just really I'm just excited at the minute. It's just like I'm
I was gonna say, are you enjoying it? Are you able to enjoy it? Because it feels like you are. And
I don't think you should be in this game if you can't enjoy it. Yes, don't get me wrong, there's days when it's stressful and it's all consuming and it's packed, your days are packed and you're knackered. But if you sit back often and go, fucking hell.
And they're, again, to not to keep saying the same thing, but they're the people you end up working with again and again, because you have also all been on set with people who feel as if they were annoyed to get the job. And you're like, and I'm there like, what the fuck are you talking about?
It's like,
this is mad. I've worked in factories, mate.
Yeah.
And like, yes, we had to wait around for a long time, but look how mad this is.
Right? Look where we are.
I've worked in retail, in factories, in deliveries. I've done all these other jobs. It's like, no, this is good.
Yeah.
Like, this is the good one.
So very, very, very grateful to be where I am now. It's it's just amazing. Every day is just a blessing, you know what I mean?
I love it, mate. Well, this has been an absolute a blessing. I know we talked about it in advance, but I love when I get pitched by PR people for people who I'm like, I love and rate. And it's like, aren't we all doing well? The fact that you've got this PR person hitting me up, the fact that I'm being hit up for some reason, I'm like, I love those moments of, a look at what we're all doing.
And then it was amazing when they were like, oh, they want you to go on Pip's podcast. I was like, fucking right I do, yeah. I love him.
Damn right, let's do it.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure, man. And we'll talk soon.
Definitely.
I appreciate you taking the time, mate.
Definitely, mate. Loads of love. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. I hope you enjoyed that. If you've not already watched Boiling Point, you're mad. You're mad, I swear. Go on iPlayer and watch Boiling Point. Go on Netflix and watch The Accused, and then watch Flashback, which I'm in on Netflix. Then come over to Twitch on Thursday the 26th and watch Host with me, okay? You've got a lot of things to do, so I'm going to just end this now because you've got a lot to get done. I'll see you next week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.